You are live, okay, Jiminy and the Wolf. And we have...
Good evening.
Special guest. Feds, Jeff Boyd, old friend from my hometown. How you doing, Jeff?
I am well. It's cold here. We got a lot of snow today. A lot, like 6 inches, 8 inches, maybe.
Wow. I'm so glad you're in Nashville.
Yeah, you guys are smart. Yep. You know, I'm here by choice.
We're glad you're here.
So, I mean, no, I mean, that too on the show, but I mean, I live in South Dakota by choice, so.
Yeah, well, that's, you're a little crazy.
I know. I should have got, maybe I should have scooted out while I could have, huh?
So,
it's nice in Indiana. I love the shirt too, by the way.
Yes, I was born in Indiana. I was telling Tim we scooted around 6 or 8, 9 times in my first 7 years and then came to South Dakota. So trotted around up North Indianapolis an hour or so, little towns and stuff where we lived, Converse and Sims, Swayze.
Nice. Why don't you give us that brief summary of all the places you lived in Indiana that you gave me earlier?
Yeah, I was born in Warsaw in December of 64. And then we moved to South Dakota in the first week of February in 72. So, you know, I was 7 years old, just a bit over. But our family moved. Okay, I was born in the – we had three houses in Warsaw, and I'm told I was born just as we moved into the third one. So maybe, Tim, I shouldn't take credit for that.
No, go forward.
And then we went Converse two places, this little town, you know, 50 miles north of Indianapolis, Converse. Then to a farmhouse between these little towns of Sims and Swayze and Converse, triangulated right in between there like a hub. Then we moved to the town of Swayze, then to Sims, then back to Converse in South Dakota. So we moved a lot. My mom, you know, she moved a lot as I was the youngest of the five kids. So there, we got two extra kids later on when I was 10. That's how I got my name, Fedge. But
wow.
So I like Indiana. You know, it's weird how my memories of Indiana are just great. Like I liked the falls, and we lived on the edge of town in that last place in Converse for a year and a half. And, you know, a bit of farmland right on the edge there. And so I have, you know, Indiana resonates with me. I like the feeling I get when I think of Indiana.
Nice. My wife and I always say that the falls in Indiana is what keeps us here.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
It's funny I mentioned that. There just were so many leaves outside. And
all the colors. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, the mulberry tree I think we had out there, we would make this jam, shake it, and us kids would run and stomp, but feet would turn purple.
Yeah.
So, simpler, little simpler time, feels like.
Sure, man.
So, yeah, I'm pro-Indiana for sure.
I like it. Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize that when I spoke to you yesterday and I was complaining about my Celtics, I didn't even realize that they were playing your team.
Yeah.
And you beat us.
Yeah. I was polite, man. I didn't throw that out there.
Well, did you know that when we were talking on the phone?
Yeah.
Man.
I was being nice about it.
Yeah, I mean, Indiana's got a pretty good team. I mean, there's a lot of strong teams in the East right now.
Sure.
You know,
I think this is as good as we've been for a while. I think Sabonis is a star, man.
Yeah, he sure is. Yeah.
And he's coming into his own finally.
But, and who's your guard? Brogdon? Is that?
Brogdon's great too. But we've got, you know, Oladipo was the man forever, but he didn't want to be there. So it's, you know.
But he's still there, right?
Yeah, he's there, but he's kind of there. Like they played back to back games, so he set out the second night. That sort of stuff. He doesn't want to be there. And that's what happens. We're such a small market, man. I mean, we deal with the same thing with our NFL team. It's such a small market. It's hard to keep big names.
Timberwolves, which is Jeff's first fandom.
Yeah, I think they have. Yeah, I have something up on the wall about them.
What does it say up there?
Well, I have a Timberwolves little round banner. I think it's Twins that's over my shoulder there, but just to the side of that, I have a little Timberwolves.
You have been,
I was a Denver Nugget fan until the Timberwolves came into existence. And then I, you know, just because of locale, I switched over to them. So it's been a journey, you know. We have 2004. We made it to a Western Conference Finals. That's it. So, but prior to that, as a kid, I was a Denver Nugget fan because, see how you guys are on trivia. Jimmy might be a little too young, but my first grade teacher was the mother of a guy named Monty Tau, who played with David Thompson and Rick Burleson and those boys when they won the championship, I believe, in 1974.
I'm not
at UCLA's big string and beat them in triple overtime in the semifinals. And so I became David Thompson and Monty Tau, who's a little 5'7" point guard that played high school basketball, just lived a block and a half from us in Converse, Indiana. He got drafted by the Nuggets, him and David Thompson, in the ABA. And they played together there the last year of the ABA. And then the Nuggets the next year were in the NBA with the Spurs and the Pacers, and the Nets were the four teams to make it out of there alive. So that wasn't too bad. There are some good Nuggets teams. They always had to play the Sixers, you know, Dr. J and those guys and stuff, Seattle and all the, so they never made it either, but. I do like the Timberwolves, but man, they can't draft. Like, you have to be able to draft. I think I typed it in last time. Johnny Flynn, he just didn't play hardly at all. And then Ricky Rubio, who said he wasn't going to play. And then came Steph Curry, number 7 that year.
They had 2 picks before Steph Curry. Steph Curry just put up, there was something in practice. He put up 105 threes consecutively in practice or something like that. He's amazing.
He just kept shooting them, or he made those?
Yeah.
Just rattled them off, huh?
Yeah, like in 45 minutes, he shot 105 threes consecutive.
Oh, man.
Something like that. It was over.
Wow. Yeah. So anyway, but I'm a loyalist. I stay with it. I try not to swap around.
Well, yeah.
We talked about that. I think you guys were talking about that last week, maybe.
Pick it and stick it is what Gary used to say. Pick it and stick it. You know, because he's a long-suffering Jets fan.
Yeah. I don't mind surrogate teams. I have to have those when you root for the teams I do, but.
Yeah.
You know.
So. One of the big news on the Eastern Conference is Harden is in play, and he apparently wants to go to Brooklyn. I don't know how they'd manage him in the cap because they already got 2 max guys in Kyrie and Durant, KD, and he'd be maxed. But, you know, a big market team, you can do more than a smaller market team. And Boston is not one of those big market teams. I mean, they're not Chicago, New York, L.A., you know, would be the big Houston should be a big market team. Houston is the fourth largest city in the country, so they should be considered a big market team. But they can't. But Harden doesn't want to stay there. You think they could pay him?
Yeah, he doesn't have much leverage. If they send him somewhere, he's got a goal. But he talks like he does, but I don't think he really does. I was wondering, I read something about a rumor that Jaylen Brown leaving for Houston and for Harden and other stuff coming and going. You know, it's so hard because drafts are so important. You were talking about how well Boston drafts those guys, Jaylen and Jason Tatum, both, you know, and sticks with them. You know, I don't know. I don't think I'd do that deal. I mean, I know Harden's great guy, great player and stuff, but he's kind of so unique that I don't think I'd do that. I don't think I'd trade him for.
Well, he's never won a championship. He's never even gotten to the conference finals, I don't think. Has he ever got? I don't think he's gotten to the conference finals.
Didn't he against Golden State that year? Or
he just doesn't. He's not a winner. I mean, there's something about being a winner. And
you have to play deep.
You have to, and you have to play defense. Yeah. So what the last thing I saw, of course, I do, sometimes I don't stay up to date, but the last thing I read today or yesterday, there's some planning on how they could trade like a 3 or 4 team deal and they could keep Jaylen Brown, but they'd have to give up Marcus Smart to get Harden.
Yeah.
And Smart has been all defensive team 2 consecutive years. He's the guy that makes those. I mean, I saw a play. I didn't watch the game. I didn't know it was on, but didn't in the close with like 11 seconds left against the Pacers, he ripped the ball out of somebody's hands and they got a dunk, Jimmy. But then
I didn't watch it.
Okay, but there was a play that the Celtics were down and went up by one with Marcus Smart ripped the apparently the replay. It looked like they ripped the – maybe even it was what's his name? Sabonis. And ripped the ball out of his hands, which is what he does. It's what he does. And passed it to for a fast break, broken play, and dunked it. And then they're up by one, but then Pacers came back and scored and won the game. So, you know, Smart is the kind of guy who makes plays like that. And you need that game 7 of a tough series, and you need guys who are going to do that. And giving him up, I don't know. I mean – it's a tough business, but how do you compete? We just don't have – they say you can't win a championship. It's really hard to win a championship without a top five player. And the Celtics don't have a top five player right now.
Well, and, you know, there's certain teams that those cards are just stacked against now because the players are pairing up and deciding where they go all of a sudden. So yeah. It makes it that much harder on the small market teams. I mean, the Pacers aren't going to get – two of the top five guys unless they draft them and groom them, and it's just coincidence. None of those guys are saying, hey, yeah, let's go to Indiana, or hey, let's go to Minnesota. It's not going to happen. They're going to L.A. or New York. You know, it's unfortunate.
Well, you do have a slightly second-tier teams like the Heat, you know, of a recent 21st century history of winning championships. And
they came in with the Timberwolves in 89, I'm pretty sure.
Sorry, say it again.
I think the Heat came into existence with the Timberwolves. Okay. Pretty close to it. 2 came in 89 and 2 in 90, I think, 2 teams. Toronto, the Raptors might have been.
Because of Pat Riley and because of Spoelstra. I mean, people want to go to the Heat now.
And the Ocean.
And the Ocean, yeah. Southern Climb, yeah. Now, Boston does have the history, and there are some people that appreciate that, but I think each year that gets less and less of a thing. And you got, they call it Taxachusetts, you know, Massachusetts high tax rate. So it's got some draw, but it's not going to be on par. It probably didn't have the same draw as the Heat, actually. It doesn't have the sunny weather. And I mean, if you're a young 20-something basketball player, and if you like going out to clubs, I mean, Miami is hopping. You know, there's a lot going on. So, and New York is New York. It's New York has got a lot of taxes too, but it's still the biggest media center in the world, in the country, maybe in the world. So I can see why KD and Kyrie decided to go to New York, and they picked the right team instead of going to the Knicks that are. Can't get out of their own way. The Knicks can't do anything right, it seems. They make bad mistakes, bad decisions. So Chicago would be a good one. You know, a couple guys said, hey, let's go to Chicago. You know, Chicago's a big market team. And they've got some history, you know. I mean, Jordan era. Nothing since then, but.
Artis Gilmore in the early days, Bob Love, when I was young. You know, they were –
historian of the game,
you stylish people.
You know.
Yeah,
it's a great city too, man. Chicago.
Yeah, you know. So
I was just to say I went to boot camp in Great Lakes, you know, in '85 in the Navy, right? I think 35 miles, and the train station dissected the recruit training command and the what they call main side. Training command, and you could take that wheel right down there into the city.
Sean Matthew Kelly said shout out to Jeff, and also shout out to the Jets.
Yeah, he's a Boston Celtic. That's my son-in-law.
Okay.
My grandson Aiden's dad, and he likes the Jets and the Boston Celtics. Die hard, both of them. So he's right there with us. He's mourning the two wins, Jets wins, yeah. I think, right now.
They missed.
So. Oh, there, if you talk about big, I mean, Jets are New York team. I mean,
yeah, and you can't. They're not tankers. You can't accuse them of that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they've looked great the last couple of weeks.
That's worth something.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was hoping they would tank and get Trevor Lawrence, because now the Jaguars are going to get him and the Colts are going to have to play him a couple times a year. So that's a bummer.
I was going to say, Tim, about Marcus Smart. His haircut the other night, whatever he did with that twirly bird thing, that's the only reason I'd get rid of him. What he did with his hair.
They were saying he looks like I did. I think not against the Pacers when he played on Christmas Day, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, he looked like a rapper, they were saying. They named some rapper who had passed away. I'm not up on my rappers. So I didn't know which one, but.
Yeah. I had this toy where it was like a gun, but you, when I was a kid, and you clicked it, and this thing top flew off into the air. And then finally would land. That's what his hair looked like. He would make a quick thing and his hair would twist like that. Had a little bead on the end. Yeah. Why? Out of all the choices he has, he's picked that. I don't know.
Yeah. It's distraction, man. He'd get his feet going one way and his hair going.
Oh, the defensive guys are trying to follow the hair, huh?
Exactly. The old razzle dazzle.
A guy for the Nets, his hair is big out there. Dr. J, Darnell Hillman looking hair now. Lee? He's the second string center now. He starts on the second squad for the Nets, but his hair is real big. Real. I thought his last name's Lee.
So I haven't seen any Nets games yet, except when they clean their clock. But I don't remember the second string center for the Nets.
Yeah, well, he started last year, I think, but now they have that DeAndre Jordan that's going to start now, and he used to play for the Clippers.
Oh, yeah, that was another big score. I mean, he's like a big three. Oh,
I know. Where'd he go, Detroit or something, and he got lost?
He was there, yeah. He's an all-star, right? I mean, they're a big three there. That's their – And if they got Harden, they'd have four All-Stars.
Yeah, that Dinwiddie got hurt though. That's a little bit of loss on the second squad.
Yeah, he's gonna be out for the season. It was a ACL.
Not quite. Yeah, not quite, I guess. But sounds like. But you know, I think NBA. Well, maybe any sport, but NBA injuries, that matters a lot too. Staying healthy.
Yeah, well, you only have 15 people, so you know.
Eight that play, 10 that play a lot, maybe.
You know, and I mean, a quarterback, I mean, you protect your quarterback, right? I mean, you quarterbacks getting injured are probably not as common as NBA players getting injured. Is that an accurate?
Yeah, I'd say for the star power, yeah. I mean, they've changed the rules to help quarterbacks stay healthy, and basketball can just be sometimes it's the freakiest plays too. It just seems like it's nothing, you know?
Right. Well, like when Hayward broke his ankle so badly, the most gruesome that I've ever seen, you know, his foot is pointing a right angle from his leg. The sole of his foot is vertical up and down, basically.
Joe Theismann, that thing. It's about.
And he's back now. I mean, he's, you know, he's playing pretty well based on what I've read. But
he's not really the same, I don't think.
No, he was, you know, when he was in Utah, he was the real deal out there. I think that injury really, I think the way he moves does his basketball moves, that injury really, really hurt him.
Yeah.
I didn't know him that well out there. So he's far away from his all-star. I mean, well, he got last year with the Celtics, he averaged 17, 18 points, and his his shooting percentage was above 50%. I mean, you would think, well, let him, if he's shooting that well, let him take more shots, you know, or maybe it was, but he was the third option.
Yeah.
It was because he was open more. And he was injured all the time. I mean, letting him go was probably not a bad thing, but he was a really good facilitator.
And a nice guy too, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Do you know that, you know, when he, there was a, he had two girls, two young girls, and his wife had a big reveal, you know, where you have the balloons, you open a box.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was, you know, filming. And of course the little girls are, you know, like 3 and 5 or whatever. And they're, well, you know, oh, I want to see what it is. And somebody was filming it and they opened the box and it's pink, you know, third girl.
Yeah.
Disappointment on Gordon's face. As the balloon goes up, it kind of gets in his face and he hits it like that. Away. And the wife looks at him. She knows her husband. And she says, are you happy? And he says, as he kind of punches the balloon, daddy's always happy. And it became a meme. They actually generated merchandise because it became a thing. Daddy's always happy. And you can actually buy merch, Gordon Hayward sponsored merch. Daddy's always happy.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah, his poor daughter, you know,
right?
18 years old, and she sees all these memes. Daddy's always happy. You didn't even want me. You wanted a son.
Yeah.
Social media lives forever, which I would like to get into that article on the New York Times. Are you okay with that, Jimmy? Was in the New York Times. I don't know if you saw this, Jeff, but there was this young woman who was in Virginia from a well-to-do middle-class family. Her parents have a company, and she, when she got her driver's license when she was 14, on Snapchat, she made a little video and sent it to her friends. And apparently, I didn't know this when I was telling you this, Jimmy, this actually was the lyrics to a song that was popular at that time, 4 years ago when she was 14. And she did this video and she said, I can drive now, and then said the N-word. She's white, but she was quoting a line to a song, which when I told you this, I didn't know that it was an actual line to a song. And she put it on Snapchat, which is only supposed to last for 24 hours. But people, I guess you can download it. I'm not a Snapchat user. I'm not familiar completely with it. Apparently, it doesn't, you know, you put it on the internet, even if it's on Snapchat, it doesn't go away. And what happened was apparently some people saved this, and it showed up in this young classmate of hers, a black boy, same age, and he saved it on his phone. And he had complained about racial prejudice, people, you know, discriminating against him and different things, you know, mild, but making comments and saying things. And he had this, I guess, grudge that he kept. And so he waited until she was a head cheerleader, and she was big on cheerleading. She wanted to go to NCAA school and be in cheerleading, and she wanted to go to the University of Tennessee, which coincidentally had just won the national championship. I didn't even know they had championships for cheerleading, as much I know about it. But she had been accepted there, and apparently she'd even made the team, was what the article said. And she was celebrating about going with the colors at home with her parents, being accepted to go to her dream school. She's going to follow her career. And after she picked her college, this classmate of hers took that video, 3-second video, where she's saying, I can drive, N-word, posted it on social media. And, of course, this was just after the Floyd killing, or the death killing. And the uproar was instantaneous. And she didn't even know that it had been posted. And, of course, she was posting pro-Black Lives Matter stuff. And she got a message from somebody, how dare you post pro-Black Lives Matter stuff when you have posted this video of you saying the N-word. She's like, what are you even talking about? And she looks on social media, and she finds this video, which became all the rage. Everybody's talking about inner school. And University of Tennessee's got pressure, and the first thing they do is they pull her from the cheerleading squad And then a day or so later, they tell her that you can't come here to school. We're retracting your acceptance to our university because you wouldn't be comfortable here. Under pressure, probably. And her life has been turned upside down. She didn't even remember doing that. She was quoting the lyrics to a song, 14 years old. And I feel bad for her. I do understand how controversial it is, but when kids don't understand what that word means and they use that word in conversation, they're just singing along to a song. They don't understand that can literally upend their life. I mean, it's first world problems, right? I mean, her family is middle class, upper middle class, apparently. She'll probably find another college, but she's not going to college now, but her dream has been shattered and she's trying to figure out how to pick up the pieces. And probably the attention span is so short, everybody will probably forget about it maybe, and she'll probably be fine. I don't know, but I think it's unfortunate.
14 years old, you don't understand the gravity behind the word itself.
At 14, right.
You know, she's still a child. And I didn't know that it was being sung in a song. So, I mean, at a certain age, everybody knows better. But when you're 14, where's the line? I mean, so many young kids are hearing that all the time, and they don't realize the gravity behind it. So it really is unfortunate for her that it's affected her life that way.
Well, it's probably a good thing they didn't have Snapchat when I was in junior high. Or, you know, people following around getting quotes from me at that age, you know.
Right.
I know that for sure, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, navigating growing up is so, so different than when I mean, it is the same. I mean, it's so far, it's.
I was telling a story not too long, a couple of days ago. Jimmy, in the 90s, I got elected to the city commission in my hometown. I didn't really plan to win, but I moved back from South Carolina, and there was no place to work out in the town of Huron, South Dakota. Tim lived there for quite a while, too. And so I just decided I would run for this office and try to talk about it and see if I could get someone that could do something about it. interested enough, and I ended up winning. But one of the more fun things I got to do is go to the police station where I had been before as a juvenile a couple of times when I was arrested as a kid. And so it was pretty fun going back 15 or 16 years later and like, hey, I remember this place.
It's a completely different person. Yeah.
Yeah. And a different, obviously, you know, role.
Sure.
But, you know, just, I was young. By that time, I was the youngest of seven, and I would do just about anything to be noticed. It didn't really matter, and a couple of those happened to be a rat, ending up getting hauled down there, you know, to the police station. So,
yeah.
It's we touched on a little bit earlier in the day too, Tim. This exchange of information with devices and the modems or whatever the word is, way that information travels upon those devices that we have. Maybe there's a better word, a bigger word that includes all of social media and just the exchange of information from one person to the other. But it's changing us, changing the human.
Big time, man.
Yeah.
Big time. That coupled with COVID this past year, and I've wondered a lot of what is that effect on little babies that are just now learning human interaction and they're used to seeing this all of a sudden. I mean, it's a strange time to be alive, and it's a strange time for human interaction as a whole.
I try to learn to smile with my eyes, and I think I'm not very good at it.
Right, sure.
Sometimes I just pull my mask down to let someone know that I'm smiling.
it's amazing to me because so much of our communication is nonverbal. And in fact, there's a guy that that I interact with on a fairly frequent basis who's a Mexican dude. I speak zero Spanish at all. And me and this guy cannot talk on the phone face to face. We can transfer all this information between the two of us. I know what he's saying. He knows what I'm saying. Like, we can work things out. We can plan things. It's amazing, dude. And over the phone, it's like, you know, come meet me somewhere. And so much of that is getting lost in the digital age that it's amazing, you know, and attention spans are getting shorter. And I'd venture to say the bonds are getting weaker too, as far as, you know, friendships with younger people. They're not out exploring with their best buddy like people work for. They're sending texts, and I mean that's a huge thing, and it's not talked about enough.
Well, it's been continuing, you know, and it's something that has been going on. I mean, you know, Generation Zers tend more to interact with their friends through video games, right? Like, sure. We'll get on a video game and interact with his friend and playing a video game and talking to each other that way. And so that has been going on. But I think the trends have been just greatly accelerated because of this pandemic. And I was reading, you know, we're at the end of the year now. And so, you know, I always try to read the New York Times on Sunday. You know, they do some big analysis. And they were analyzing, you know, how's the world going to be different after COVID? Eventually, we're going to be out of this. There's no doubt. Eventually, there's going to be a point in time where we're going to be able to, you know, one of the examples was, imagine, you know, going into a crowded bar and going up to the bar and ordering a drink, and you put your palm down on the bar and it's sticky and it's with someone else's substance and you don't think anything about it and you're screaming, spits coming out, or, hey, I want a beer, you know, and you're not worried about any of that, you know. That's the way it was pre-COVID. I mean,
sure.
I mean, one day we'll be back there. One day we will be, but how long is it going to take? Now they're saying maybe the second half of 2021, maybe even 2022, you know, vaccines and all this sort of thing. And they're saying you have to have multiple vaccines. So even though we get back to that, life will be, there'll be a lot of things that have changed. I think this COVID has already accelerated trends that are probably already happening.
Yeah, I remember drinking out of the Ohio River when I was a little boy, so I can't get COVID. I'm pretty sure I'm immune to that and just about anything else.
I've got antibodies, so
right.
I don't know about it, but
I feel I do too. I mean, I remember going barefoot. In fact, the neighbor at my dad's funeral, we sat and talked for a while, and he was a few years younger than me. And he remembered when his dad hired my dad to help harvest, and it was wheat, so it was in the summer. And he said, I brought the truck, and I wasn't wearing any shoes. And he remembers me somehow when I got out of the truck, I'd stepped in some cactus, and he had this very, very jarred in his mind memory because I was the older kid. You know, I was like 4 or 5 years older. You know how older kids you always look up to. I suppose, I hope he didn't follow my actions. He said that I was sitting on the end of the running board of the truck with a pair of pliers pulling cactus out of the bottom of my foot because I'd stepped in a cactus. And, you know, so I remember having cow pies, you know, not dried cow pies, squish up in between my toes. You know, I'd be walking out. And so I've walked in a lot of stuff. And I probably have a lot of antibodies, like you said. you know, apparently, I don't remember going barefoot that much. I mean, we had shoes. I don't know why I was. No.
You're trying to keep them clean.
Maybe. So.
Born in South Dakota, Tim.
What's that?
Born in South Dakota. Evidently, shoes are optional some part of the time.
Yes. Yeah. So, well, Jeff, anything you would like to talk about on your first?
I was going to. You said last week about you mentioned something about looking back. You know, you do your year-end review or whatever. Which I wish I did. I don't get around to doing that too. I might write something every fifth year or something on Facebook about my year. But so this story came to mind. A lot of times what happens to me is I hear something and it reminds me of something. And it's whatever I'm reminded of is way better than I can describe it to myself. So this describes what you guys were talking about a little bit. But I worked. It was the summer of 84. And after my first year of college, my parents moved from Huron to Sioux Falls. So that's where I went for that next summer. I'm an 83 graduate. And I got a job making microwave ovens at Litton's in Sioux Falls. And it was pretty hard work. It was 1,080 was our quota of microwaves per day. And so they were just flying off of there. And so within a couple people each way, I was pretty close to the first part of the start of the line, a couple of jobs in. And then about three or four guys to my left, and then that would have been two people to my right. So there's a dozen or 14 people that you get to know really well because you're just sitting there talking, and you have to go a little bit deep. Otherwise, you're just staring at each other. So my pretty close mate, maybe one person away, came to work one day and said, oh, my Ranchero got stuck in reverse, and I had to drive it backwards down Cliff Avenue 3.5 miles.
Cliff Avenue?
Yeah.
They drag.
I know, way from the top of the hill all the way up to the bottom of the penitentiary there. and so the person that said, yeah, it's probably okay to review, but don't go stopping and looking backwards. I thought, okay, if he's talking about driving backwards in a Ranchero, which was better than some cars because the window was the end of the car, you know, for that. I see his point, but if it's just like stopping for gasoline and, you know, pondering the last little bit of your journey, you know, that's a whole nother thing that I think is pretty healthy and necessary. Probably should be more. Sure. So that's something that I just wanted to highlight from last week.
Well, I'd also, while I'm thinking of you, some unique experiences that you've had when you graduated college or high school, when you joined the service.
Yeah, 2 years out, I went to boot camp. And then I was in the reserves a while, and then went off to live on a submarine.
Yeah, that is not too many people experience that, and that's very unique, I think, environment, right?
Not a lot of people sign up for prison, you know, voluntarily, but it was physically like prison, but that's about it, because the interpersonal was the opposite of probably what prison time feels like. It was for me, it was amazing. You had to get along with people, so you did. But I learned a lot in a relatively small amount of time about a lot of things. And everybody I meet, I think I'm able to, you know, it feels like there's 10, 15, 20 categories of people, one of which was on that submarine, of each group of that. So sometimes I'll meet people and I go, oh, that reminds me of that guy, or okay. I get a lay of the land. I almost everywhere I travel, seems like.
And you're from a huge family, and that helps a lot too.
Yeah.
In being exposed to personalities growing up, I find for me personally, like coming up in bars, playing music in bars, working in bars, working in restaurants, and having a lot of siblings. By the time I was like 21, I literally met and dealt with a lot of every kind of personality that you could possibly
have.
Big families kind of have that tendency, man. It's almost like there's no personality tendencies that are going to blindside you at any point, because you've probably already dealt with it.
Yeah. I think that's true. It could be, if it does I'd say this, if it has blindsided me, it's because it was part of that family, and I just, it soaked in so much, it seemed more normal than it should have been, maybe.
Right.
And I'm sure my own behavior was that way too, you know. Like, I think there's times where I go, why did I why for those amount of years did I act like that? Or yeah. Why did I have that basic outlook? Because it, as I grow older and stuff, I go like, no, that's going to have to throw that one out about myself. So
how many people were on the submarine? And I'm guessing they're all men back then, or were there some?
Yeah. Thankfully all men. I don't know. I don't think speaking personally, I'd be glad if they're not that they couldn't do it. You know, it'd be my, I think there are now, but we didn't have any, and not that they couldn't, but it would be trickier for me to serve on there. I think I would have to say that, but yeah. One thing that's interesting about that time, late 80s, early 90s, there you could smoke there on board still. And so my immediate supervisor, Petty Officer Gramley, I think his name was, he smoked, you know. So people would come down that had run out of cigarettes or couldn't afford them when they came on, and just sit in our little two-person office and, like, you know, breathe the side of the filing cabinet, because it was so, you know, it was still so thick in there, you know. So that, I don't think that happens near as much today, like just as much smoking in the service as.
Well, how many?
154, I think, if I remember right. 154.
154 guys.
Yeah, and if I remember right, it's a 400 foot long boat. So
you've told me a little bit about your role. Your role was a little bit of a.
I was a storekeeper.
Yeah, and that everybody wanted to curry your favor. Talk a little bit about.
Well, I'll talk about that a little bit. I learned quick. If you are jolly when they wake you up in the middle, like first of all, you don't. If you haven't qualified, you don't get a lot of sleep. If you're junior, you know, you're busy doing stuff, and then if you get sleep, seems like they call these drills. You know, they got to be like when you least expect it. And so it's like, felt like every time I decided I had to do my watch station, which was driving the boat or working in the sonar room. And then I had to pull parts and do all that and qualify, try to get some sleep. And whatever order it seemed like I did it in, the inverse was of the drills. The drills would come whenever I picked to sleep, you know. And so a lot of times when I was sleeping, if that didn't happen, someone would go down, and I was the junior storekeeper. There's just two of us and the supply officer, and we called him Chop, and I wasn't going to let him pull parts. So usually it was me, you know, he probably would have, he was a good guy. He's exactly my same age too, but he went to college first. I didn't go till after. So I did that in the wrong order probably. So we were the exact same age, and he's my boss. And anyway, but I learned quick. It was kind of a luxury being this person that they needed to go to for parts, because I had access to space, number one thing, keys to lots of lockers, and that's the number one commodity, toilet paper and space. That's the two things, maybe hot water. And then I learned quick, man, if I get up with a good attitude, I'm going to be popular guy here. And another thing I comes to my mind sometimes, like if someone leaves a purse in a restaurant, if you turn it in, you're a hero, and if you keep it, you're the total thug, right? Like there's no in between on some things in life, no gray part, like. Yeah. And that's how it was pulling parts. If you got up and were jolly, they were like, could you, Petty Officer Boyd, man, he was happy, as he seemed happy to come up and get it, you know. And then if you're, oh man, like that, then it's the opposite thing circulates on that boat, you know. So I learned pretty quick. It was a pretty small investment to just go, all right, you know, I'm going to try to make this work to everybody's good.
You know? I love it, man. You decide your mood. It's absolutely true.
And it sets the mood of others. Sure. Another trick I did is when I told you I drove the boat, I would do helmsman for 2 hours. Three of us would on 6 hour shifts. Our whole patrol was 6 hours on, 12 hours off. 6 hours on, 12 hours off. And the off was busy time for me, the job I had. But that's for like 110 days, like that, Zulu time. So we do 2 hours driving one set of planes and the other one, helmsman, planesman. And then we'd be the messenger. So we were the gopher of anybody that outranked us, basically could tell us to do stuff, go get something or, you know, empty the trash or whatever. We're just sitting there on a chair little stool by the con and run it. So one of your jobs was to go wake people up if your 2-hour shift fell on the last when the 6 hours was finishing up. So every third time I was a messenger, and I learned bedside manner quick on that. And Ensign Joe, this friend of mine, he was probably a little younger than me even. He was his first patrol, and he'd say, "Oh, wake me up again, Petty Officer Boyd." So I'd say, "All right, hey, Ensign Joe, it's time to get up, my friend," like that. And just these little things that you learn. But I kind of figured them out quick and did them. But if you didn't, you were going to find out the answer anyway, you know, the other way. So it was, I wouldn't trade that time in. That's helped me a lot, I think.
That's great stuff, man. And, you know, that's applicable across the board in life, anywhere and everywhere you go.
Yeah. I mean, I just, I deliver Jimmy John's. That's my main gig here. And it's the same thing. Like,
sure.
I just invest like 8 seconds, and one thing about me, I can't be fake. I wish I kind of could be, because I think it's times that comes in handy, like to just be kind of non-committal and this and that, but I'm not built that way. So when I interact with people, even just handing them a sandwich, I'm excited that they bought this sandwich. You know, those are expensive sandwiches when you get one delivered and then a dollar something for a soda or whatever. But especially in these COVID times, they're happier than clams when you show up with their food, you know. And a lot of it, the schools are just, a lot of them you just drop on a table and you wave, you know, and you catch eyes. And I always, I don't know if I'm supposed to, but I honk at this one grade school and I just rile up the kids when they're at recess, you know. And they know my vehicle already, so they know, hey, it's that one Jimmy John's guy. So they come to the fence and I just, so I'll probably be busted now, but. You know, they can tell like that that they matter to me, and they do, you know. So I think some of that submarine life, I picked some of that stuff up, you know.
You know, man, the whole thing is like people won't always necessarily remember what you do or what you have or what you make, but people will always remember how you made them feel.
How you make them feel.
How you make them feel, man. You know, there's.
I'm sure the three of us do remember how people make the three of us feel throughout our lives.
Absolutely, man. You know, and it's the simplest thing. And the way you said it, it was perfect, man. Like you made the decision. This is how I'm going to interact with these people. So you consciously decided, you know, I'm going to make this as easy greasy as possible. And you probably changed that whole environment of where you were at, man.
Yeah. You know, they don't give away. I noticed this in my city commission job and on the submarine. They don't give away like a free pass just because you showed up. Right. You have to kind of earn your way into the club. Mm-hmm. And I did a better job of that in the Navy than I did on the city commission. I had a pretty big attitude my first half a year there. And I shouldn't have. But I did. You know, it's like, hey, I'm elected now, you know.
All right.
I got humbled up plenty quick on that. But,
I have too.
So but on the boat, you know, I think I lost my train. Oh, okay. So there's just this one guy that just was on my watch, and I could tell he's watching me really close. And he was like one of the guys that just didn't give his little, voice of approval to just anybody, right? Like he was like the last guy to say, okay, in my opinion, you're part of the, and I'm Facebook friends with him even now. But one time he racked me out and we had to go to a part that had never been hit in the history of the boat. So we're talking like 28 or 9 years, this part had never broken down and it wasn't under maintenance to be replaced, right? So we get to this locker that I didn't even know existed. It was up behind and I think it was a missile, lower level missile or upper level, up in the ceiling. So, you know, either low up or third level way up. And I opened that thing and it's just all dust. Like, I don't know if anything had been pulled out of that locker ever. And I think there was probably 300 and some parts in there. And they're all like spark plug type size, you know, like little light bulb size pieces. And so I said, hey, we got some work to do. So we looked around and made a little strategy for where to start putting these parts. And we got about a third of the way in there. And he just looks at me and he says to me, are we going to find this? And I said, it's in there. I said, that's not the question. It's just how many ledges are we going to have to invent, you know, for these parts? Because they are all stacked in there like the day, you know, from the shipyard. We got about another third of the way in there and we popped that thing out. And not only was I not part of the group, that was my biggest ally the rest of my time on that boat. Yeah. Was that guy. And he was the hardest nut to crack, you know, but that did it.
You won over him.
Yeah, he looked in my eyes and I said, it's in there, you know, like, and they needed it bad. Like it was a big, it was an event, you know, yeah. Sometimes. So those things are opportunities. I think this COVID, I hope, is a whole opportunity. It's made us do things differently and look at things differently and, sure. You know, cherish things we never would have thought of.
Right. I hope it makes us cherish things more.
Well, I mean, those who have eyes and ears to hear, Tim, you know, like those people that want to take that look at life that way to start with, I think they'll find plenty.
Things that we had before COVID and we've lost because of COVID that we took for granted. I mean, it's going to be, you're going to value that a little bit more, you know.
For sure. For sure. And then other things like that. Well, like at where I work, we used to have corporate come around a lot, right? But now, for great reasons, corporate's decided that's probably not the best idea, having a guy move from state to state, you know, 12 times a year, coming from one store to the next, to the next, to the next. I suppose those field guys had, what, 40 stores or something each or whatever.
Which job was that you're talking about?
That's when I'm doing Jimmy John's now, you know.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just saying, I'm not saying it's obsolete, but I'm just saying the stores are still producing well and all that. But in the restaurant industry, that's mainstay. Like you always have to have this person that comes and travels from corporate and look at your stores, you know.
Sean says that the theater industry is going to have a big change from COVID. Yeah, absolutely. Theater, yeah, Sean, right. You know, any performances. I mean, I was happy to see that in the live music blogs that I do get, that I subscribe to, that the president did sign a bill that is giving support to live venues. And I think theater might be included in that. I think it's pretty sure that it is, not just music, but also theaters. And it will, what it'll do, it'll give a grant equal to 40% of the revenue that the entity got in 2019.
I see.
And so, and it's a grant. Mm-hmm. And the possibility to get a second grant for half of the first grant. So you could get up to 60% of your revenue, which could be the difference between life and death for some of these entities if they're still going on.
And right.
And even if they've closed, that building is still there. Hopefully all of the infrastructure is still there. And hopefully these things come back.
Yeah.
It would be horrible to not have theater and live music at the same level that we had before. In fact, we need more of both of those things, in my opinion. Even before COVID, we didn't have enough, but I may be biased. But
yeah. Well, when I moved to Florida, part of my big game plan, I found a church down there that had a lot of these, what they call life groups, you know, and a food truck in Daytona Beach and things like that. I just was down there for about 6 months a couple years ago. And, you know, that would not be that wouldn't even be on the table for any of that whole strategy that I had for that sector of my life. You know, the stuff that they do, they can't really do. You know, those people meeting in homes and bowling on Fridays and just the things that I did, you know, to keep myself busy and ingrained into other humans' lives at the time. What would I mean, the beach would still be there down there, Ormond Beach, where I live, but, you know, that whole like strategy would be obsolete for the while, because you can't do that right now. That kind of stuff, you know, tutoring on Thursdays at the grade school. I don't even know if they have a grade school right now.
I talked to a friend of mine yesterday, and his father passed this year. His father was 77, and he made the comment, and I knew his father, and his father had a routine. The highlight of his days, every day he would come into our local VFW. He was a veteran, and his favorite world was to come into our local VFW and drink beer and play pull tabs. And the son made the comment yesterday, and I said, well, what happened, you know? And he said, well, he gave up. He said that he basically said his father pretty much told him that he couldn't do what he wanted to do anymore, and he just gave up. And it's unfortunate because there have been those kind of casualties to COVID of people that, you know, mental health has declined, or they you're not socializing. They just lose the will to live.
Yeah.
Something, man.
Sean says, you wonder what crowds will be like for movie theaters since we have seen such a big rollover into streaming with HBO. You know, I concerned about that as well. And there was a big article in the New York Times a week or two ago about that. And they were saying that the movie theater, the movie business will never be the same, the theater, the delivery.
Yeah.
But then one optimist said, he said that the Roaring 20s, he was talking specifically about movies. He said the Roaring 20s happened after the last pandemic, and the pent-up demand is going to be so strong that he thinks it's going to come back roaring. Now, the one thing that he left out is the Roaring 20s also happened after World War One, so there was a lot of pent-up, not just the pandemic, but World War One. I mean,
sure, sure.
So there, but there was definitely, that was one of the craziest decades probably in our country's history. You know, it was crazy. People, everybody wanted to get out, and we had prohibition during that time, which is really interesting. But
is that during the 20s prohibition was?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
But it was crazy. I mean, people just wanted to get out and have a good time, and it was, and then of course a little bit too crazy, because then we had Black Friday or Black 1929, or was it Black Monday, whichever it was, when the crash, and then we had a depression for most of the 30s, and in the Midwest we had the Dirty 30s because it dried up, and coincidentally, where there wasn't any crops growing, and you know, you have a building or a house that was built during that time, and you get into the walls, if you happen to remodel it, there's like a foot of dust inside the walls. I mean, it really did blow. You know, I don't know if it blew in Indiana quite that bad, but in the Dakotas, it was the dirty, they called it the dirty.
And that's a coincidence compared to the...
It's a coincidence. I don't think it had anything to do... I mean, the talk about adding, you know, injury. I mean, we had the depression, and then on top of it, we had a drought, and the wind's blowing, and we had the dirty 30s, you know, and... it was just stacking misfortune on top of misfortune. And, you know, and then World War II, you know, so those are some tough decades, you know, to go from World War One. I mean, 20 years isn't very long. It'd be like getting done with a huge war around the turn of the century, 2000. 2000 wasn't that long ago. I mean, the distance between World War One and World War Two was really short. I mean,
right. And then, you know, like Happy Days, I guess, had to be in there somewhere, but there's the Korean War and then the Vietnam War. Like I might be one of the most blessed ages. You guys are just a little each side of me. So maybe this would be a cool little thing to talk about. But, you know, I think peacetime from Vietnam to Gulf One is the longest peacetime. Close to it in our whole history, 16, 17 years. There was the Falklands in there, I think, in 82, Grenada or something, a couple little hiccups, but, you know.
Well, we have
gone. We've gone from.
You know, well, then we had the first war, and then while we've had people over, I guess, small forces, we still have people over in Afghanistan, and the second Iraq war, right?
Yeah, first Gulf War is 91, I think. Started and didn't last a real long time, but then 9/11 was 10 years later. So I mean, unless you guys can think of a time more than 20 years or 15, 20 years that we haven't been one war to the next, you know. in the 1800s or something, but Civil War finished up in the middle.
They certainly weren't as all, even what we've had, I mean, no disservice to those who did serve, but we haven't had an all-encompassing war since.
Right, like in World War II, I think toys didn't get made and pennies and, right, you know, bullets were made and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know.
And the Vietnam War was pretty tough. I mean, we lost a lot of people. We lost 50,000 people. But since the Vietnam War, I mean, one loss is too many. But we haven't had
more injuries than deaths, I think, like than we're used to. Some of the people in the other wars earlier in our history died because we didn't have technology or, you know, a way to fight. But there's a lot of injured, a lot of PTSD, a lot of.
Well, World War I, France, which most of the war was fought on their ground, they had 4 million injured and about 1.5 million deaths.
Oh boy.
The population was only about 40 million people. So that's why they waved the white flag when 20 years later, they hadn't even recovered from the previous war.
Yeah.
You lose all those 5.5 million people are injured or dead, and your population is only less than 40 million. You know, all your young men are pretty much decimated.
Yeah, I mean, and so that's 15% of the population, but how much of a percentage of fighting men is that?
Pretty high. And so when it came time to, you know, they were invaded, I mean, they didn't have the will or the manpower to really fight. I mean, I know it's common to make fun of them and say they just waved the white flag, but they had just been through a devastating loss just 20 years earlier. Yeah, I learned that, or I really was driven home to me when I was in Paris and I went to the War Museum. I spent about a day there. It was really fascinating. Well, what was really fascinating, going all the way back to the armor, you know, the like from, you know, the Middle Ages, you know, the full suit of armor, you know, and heavy armor. They had a whole really interesting wing that had all of these pieces of armor that was literally from the Middle Ages. I mean, so this thing, the museum went not just from, you know, the 20th century, but way back to medieval times. Really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, man's inhumanity to man is staggering, you know. Just.
Yeah, it's for all. It's funny, man, because for all of the things that we've invented and all the creations of mankind, we have never been more creative or inventive with anything than we have as creating new ways to kill each other. Yeah. There's like a million cool ways to do it. You know what I'm saying?
It's, what's wrong with us, you know?
Oh, dude, it's a great question.
Yeah. Something is.
Maybe we'll figure it out next year.
Well, it's worth pondering anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, shall we call it? It's been an hour, over an hour. It's a pretty one. I really enjoyed having you on, Jeff. And
thank you for having me.
Have you ever, next time or not? We'll talk about that if you want to continue. But anything else you want to say, Jimmy?
Happy New Year. Cheers to 2021. And very disturbing fact, in another couple of days, there's going to be people that were born in the year 2000 that will be able to legally drink. That's mind-blowing to me, man.
Does it feel like these two decades were way quicker than 80 to 2000 or 60 to 80 or like...
Mind-blowing.
Feels like it to me.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, see, 2000, like I was talking about 20 years ago, just think about how recent 2000 was. Insane. Just imagine they had a war, just an incredible war like they had in World War I. That was only 20 years apart. So, anyhow.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Good night, Jimmy.
Jimmy D and the Wolf. See you next time.
Peace.